So today's reading comes from Mark chapter 8, verses 27 to 38. And if you're using the church Bibles, it's on page 1012. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, but Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels."
Thanks so much, Alita. Do feel free to keep that open. If you've got a Bible or some other device so that you can follow along. Well, it's all been leading to this point, really. You know, if Mark's gospel were a play, then we're in the final scene before the interval. If you like, this is the dramatic conclusion to Act 1, and we're going to see trailers for Part 2, and actually we in our series in Mark's gospel are also having an interval after this Sunday. And so this is an important scene. It's an important scene because actually most of the key messages of the Christian faith are here. And so if maybe you've been perhaps watching from home or watching videos over the last 18 months, and sometimes you're struggling to grasp what is Christianity actually all about, this is a good passage. This should explain most of it. We're getting to the heart of what it is to be a Christian here in this section. But it would be wrong to suggest that this is simply a play where we get to be the audience. You know, plays are nice, aren't you? You can kind of sit back and watch all the action on stage. Well, this is one of those plays where the audience gets invited to participate. And so if we're going to just sit back this morning, what we're going to find actually is questions coming at us. Questions where we're pulled into the action. So three big themes of the Christian faith. Here's the first. Who is Jesus? Who is Jesus? Jesus and the disciples, they're traveling along on foot. And as they're walking along, Jesus asks his disciples this question. Who do people say I am? Now that's been a question that's been hanging around Mark's gospel thus far. You know, Jesus did things, and he taught things such that people asked the question, who is this man? We've already seen it, actually, in Mark chapter 4. Jesus calms a storm. It's witnessed by those who were there at the time. Who on earth is he? And so Jesus turns to his disciples and sort of asks, you know, what's the word on the street or well, the word in the village? You know, who do people think I am? Because, well, clearly he's no normal human being. And the disciples come up with various possibilities people are talking about. John the Baptist, Elijah, one of the prophets. You know, they're trying to work out who he is, and some people think, well, he must be some great character from the past who's come back. Maybe that's who he is. It kind of feels like people are grasping at straws, really. They're just flummoxed. They can't really explain Jesus. And then Jesus turns and changes the question. He no longer asks, you know, what are people saying? He turns to the disciples directly and says, what about you? Who do you say I am? and they're put on the spot. Yeah, this becomes a vital moment for the disciples. Maybe it's a moment that some of us can resonate with. Yeah, maybe that for a while we're kind of observers of Christianity. Yeah, we're intrigued, interested. Maybe we've got friends who are Christians, and so we kind of observe at a distance and we listen to what people say. Actually, all of that's fine and necessary. But there comes a moment of decision, doesn't there? When actually we have to face the question for ourselves, who do I think Jesus is? What do I make of him? Yeah, many of us, if we're Christians and we weren't Christians from a young age, we'll have faced that moment of, well, what do I make of Jesus? What's my response to him? And that's the moment that Peter and the disciples face. Okay, we've observed him, we've learned about him. Who do you say that I am? And Jesus responds with the word, Peter responds, you are the Messiah. Now, Messiah means anointed one. There are various roles in the Old Testament, mainly kings, where to fulfill that role, you were anointed with oil. Still happens, I think, actually, in the coronation. I think the queen was anointed with oil when she was crowned back in 1953. So Messiah literally means anointed one, means a king. But actually, there's a sense of it's more than just a king. Because what had happened in the Old Testament was there were various promises of an ultimate king who would arrive on the scene, a king who would be great and who would put all that is wrong right. Not just a king, but the king, the ultimate Messiah. And when Peter is faced with the question, who is Jesus, that's the conclusion he comes to. He is the king, the ultimate king, the Messiah, the long-expected one. You are the Messiah, you're the king. And you can understand why Peter's come to that conclusion. You see, he's seen Jesus close up. He's seen the miracles. He's heard the wisdom, the authority of the teaching. Or, it's worth reflecting on this, he's been with Jesus close up day after day after day after day. I'm pretty sure if anybody was with me day after day after day after day, they'd quite quickly conclude I wasn't the Messiah. You know, it's always struck me, Peter's seen everything. He's seen Jesus tired, he's seen Jesus sick, and yet the quality of life, his quality of teaching, the miracles he performs, you're the Messiah. It is a title of authority. You know, this is a king who has the right to command. The right position before a Messiah is to bow before him and to obey him because he's greater. He's the Messiah. And that essentially wraps up part one of Mark's gospel. This question that's been hanging around for chapter Pancha, who is he? Has now been answered. And answered in a hugely important way. You see, this changes everything. If it's not true, if Jesus isn't the Messiah, feel free to ignore him. But if Jesus is the Messiah, if all the evidence points towards that conclusion, then it matters hugely. Because it means that there is a God who has got purposes for his world and a purposes for people in his world, including us. And his purposes revolve around this man. This Jesus, this Messiah. That's to say, if Jesus is the Messiah and we ignore him, we will always miss out on the purpose of the universe. We will always miss out on the Creator's plans for our lives. If Jesus is the Messiah, then to ignore him is basically to miss out on what this whole world is about. By contrast, to embrace him means to be in line with the Creator's plans for our lives. Because they all revolve around Jesus. He is the Messiah. And that really wraps up part one. But we get trailers for part two of Mark's Gospel. We're just going to look at the trailers for the moment. Hopefully we'll get back to Mark's Gospel at some point in the future. Because the second question, if you like, then becomes, well, what is Jesus' mission? Why is he here? Why do God's plans for the world revolve around Jesus? And you see, the job description for the Messiah was pretty much ingrained on people's minds. He's going to sort stuff out, and things needed sorting out. Because at this point in history, well, the Romans have occupied Israel. They're bringing about injustice and so on. And so the expectation is the Messiah is this great king who's going to sort all that out. He's going to drive out the Romans, give Israel their land back. What isn't expected is Jesus' idea of the role of the Messiah. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teacher of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. Now, of course, the problem is if we've kicked around churches for a while, we're used to this. But I wonder whether we can somehow recapture the shock of it. You know, Jesus has just been recognized as Messiah. This is, if you like, the high point of his career. You know, imagine, I don't know, the president, the prime minister, the day after they've been elected. My ambition for the next 4 years is to get myself executed. Crazy, wasn't it? Not at all what anybody would expect. And yet that's roughly what is going on here. I mean, just feel the shock of it. How revolutionary this is. The great king who's going to a cross. I mean, you can hardly blame Peter for his response. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. You know, Jesus, have you lost your mind? You think of what you can do. Think of the powers you've got. Think of our need. And you're talking about being put to death by the Jewish leaders and the Roman authorities? You're stronger than them. And Jesus says to him, "Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Jesus' ambition is clear. He's going to the cross. And the one person actually who will seek to get him away from the cross is Satan. And so in seeing the suggestion that he should avoid the cross, he's seeing the temptation of Satan there. More than that, he realizes that Peter is thinking human, not God. Because, of course, the human thing, the human way of thinking would be, great king, use your strength, get an army together. That's the human way of thinking. To have a king who chooses to go to the cross, that's divine. That can only be a plan that comes down from heaven. Only God has that sort of concern. And actually, this is a hugely significant thing, isn't it? That actually Jesus is establishing a principle. To go down the path of trying to gain power and do things that way, that is a human way of working. To go down the path of the cross, that's a divine way of working. To choose deliberately the path of weakness and for things to be accomplished through that, that's divine. That's God's concern. He is the king who chooses to go to the cross. Now, in this passage, Jesus doesn't really spell out why he must go to the cross. I say that awaits the second half of Mark's Gospel. When the second half of Mark's Gospel, we learn that the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. You know, ransom, I guess often we use it in terms of kidnap these days. At the time, it was mainly in terms of slavery. You know, people were slaves, and the way you bought them out was you paid a ransom price for them. And Jesus is saying, the reason I must go to the cross, it's because actually all human beings are currently in slavery. Slavery to sin, that's to say slavery to an anti-God mentality. That means we ignore or disobey God. All of us are slaves to that. And the only way we can be free, free to live the lives God wants us to live, is for a price to be paid, the ultimate price, the death of the Messiah. And Jesus says, I must go. I must go and do that, that you might be set free. There really is nothing like it in the world. You know, there was nothing like this in Roman religion. You know, the gods who came in Roman religion, by and large, they're great warriors, the chief gods. There's nothing like this in Islam, actually. You know, Muhammad was a successful military leader. Nothing really like this in ancient society. This is new. This is radical. A Messiah who must be killed. One of the most remarkable books that I've read in the past year is Dominion by the historian Tom Holland. It's not a small book, it's about 594 pages. Lockdown was useful for something. He's a historian, he's not a Christian, he's an agnostic. But he does argue that Christianity has utterly transformed society. You know, that actually the society we live in is deeply impacted by Christianity, even if people don't realize it. And he says the thing that has changed it was this utterly revolutionary thing of a king who died on a cross. He writes, that a man who had himself been crucified might be hailed as a god could not help but be seen everywhere across the Roman world as scandalous, obscene, grotesque. And indeed, you find ancient sort of graffiti mocking Christians for worshipping this king on a cross. It was grotesque, it was new, it was radical. People couldn't get their heads around it. And yet, of course, over history, Christianity ends up being embraced. And as Christianity gets embraced, this idea that a king could come on a cross, well, that begins to transform society. Because, of course, actually, if you have a God who is just always strong, who are the people you're going to value? Well, you're going to value the strong. But actually, if the chief religion in a place is all about a king who embraces weakness, well, then actually weak people begin to matter. You can see that, can't you, in society? You know, why is it that we care about those who are sick? Well, partly there's the impact of Christianity there. Why are we concerned about refugees across the world? Because, well, Christianity. A king who dies on a cross, that changes the way we view the world. Again, here's Tom Holland. It is the audacity of finding in a twisted and defeated corpse the glory of the creator of the universe that serves to explain the sheer strangeness of Christianity and of the civilization to which it gave birth. Now, of course, Mark 8 will say that Jesus' death on the cross is only an apparent defeat. 3 days later, he will rise. But Holland is right. It is strange. It is unusual. It is counter to the way we normally think. That a Messiah is most glorified in shameful agony by dying on a cross. Utterly radical. The Messiah who chooses to die. Bow down and worship, for this is your God. But of course, all that then raises a last question. What must followers of a crucified king do? What must followers of a crucified king do? Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Now, I said at the beginning that in many ways, this is a passage that summarizes the key themes of Christianity. And so here it is. Jesus is the Messiah who chooses to go the pathway of the cross and calls his disciples to follow behind. That's it. Jesus is the Messiah who goes to a cross and calls his disciples to follow in the same path. And there are three elements to this. If we want to be Jesus' disciples, we must deny ourselves, we must take up a cross, and we must follow Jesus. That's the essential calling of the Christian. Self-denial. Going through the shame, the humiliation, the kind of death, actually, to certain things of a cross. All because we're following in the pathway of Jesus, who we're looking to as the one we're following. We've all denying ourselves. Many of you will know that, as well as being pastor here, I work part-time for a group called Living Out. And it's a group of us who've people who are attracted to people of the same sex, but who agree with Jesus' teaching that marriage is for man and a woman. And over the last couple of weeks, I've been recording some podcasts, which have been a new experience, and we've been kind of trying to deal with some of the sort of big questions that come at us. And one of the questions we dealt with was, you know, how can you ask people to give up a sexual or romantic relationship? How can you ask people to give that up? Well, it's no surprise we landed on this verse, actually. If anybody wants to be my disciple, they must deny themselves. That is to say, to be a Christian, there will be certain things we might want that we have to say no to. Oh, that might be in the area of sexuality and romance. Or it might just be in other areas where actually we have this sort of deep desire to run after something, but either it's something that Jesus disobeys, or if we prioritize it, it will be something that will lead us away from serving Jesus wholeheartedly. And Jesus says, if you want to be my disciple, it will involve self-denial. It will involve saying no to certain things. Maybe it will be the temptation. Just we naturally have a short temper, and rather than indulging that, we're going to have to work to say no. Or something else where, rather than just saying, this is who I am, I'm going to do that, we say, no, there will be certain aspects of who I am that I'm going to say no to in order to live for Jesus. There probably should be some area of our life where there's denial going on. Some area of our life where we're saying no to what I would naturally do because Jesus comes first. Or it will involve taking up our cross. That will speak of various things. One level, it will speak of a willingness to die to maybe in our lives in some parts of the world. It will involve dying to certain desires and ambitions. It will involve embracing shame. Yeah, I mentioned in a sense, I think our culture owes a lot to Christianity, but increasingly our culture doesn't recognize that. And there will be times, and I always feel for kids at school, because often I think they end up on the front line of this, but wherever we are, where to be known as a Christian might be to embrace the shame of the cross. And yet we don't hide, but we say, you know, I'm going to be unashamed of the Son of Man. Actually, that's where verse 38 goes, where Jesus commands us not to be ashamed of him. Self-denial, saying no to temptations, making sacrifice in terms of things like time, money, facing the shame of the cross. Why? Well, not for its own sake, but because we're following the King. It would be incongruous, wouldn't it, to have a King, this great Messiah who pursues this radical route to the cross. And for us to say, yeah, but my life is basically about Jesus and ease. It would be wrong, wouldn't it? It'd be incongruous. No, we're following in his pathway. Can I reflect on this a little bit? The phrase that's been used a lot in emails over the last 18 months has been this phrase, hasn't it? Stay safe. And actually, keeping other people safe, it seems to me, is actually a genuinely good thing to do. We should keep other people safe. But I have to admit, the thing that's been weighing on my mind is actually as a pathway for Christian discipleship, stay safe is awful. And forgive me, I'm not particularly talking about COVID here primarily, but of course, one of the dangers of the last 18 months are just things that sort of leak into us and apply to other things as well. actually, if the Christian life becomes staying safe, staying comfortable, staying easy, that's the very opposite of what Jesus is saying here. Part of him wants to start sending emails saying, take risks, carry your cross, Andy. But because actually, that is the pathway. That is the pathway that Jesus calls us to. And actually, if we get into a pattern of thinking, well, I might be a bit uncomfortable doing that, that doesn't feel very easy, that doesn't feel very safe, it might be that Jesus in the morning is saying to us, well, no, if anyone wants to be my disciple, they must deny themselves, take up their cross and follow me. That there will be some element of cost, of discomfort, of unease. Now, you might be saying to me, Andy, that's not the most encouraging advert for Christianity you've ever given. Or blame Jesus, he said it. But actually, Jesus motivates us. Verse 35, whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? And Jesus says, you can ignore this. You can say, well, following Jesus, that will cost me this, and I don't want to give up that. Following Jesus, it might just be a bit embarrassing and awkward. I don't want to do that. Jesus says, you can ignore this, but actually, you will lose your life. You can hold on to your comfort. You can have an easy, quiet life, but the result is ultimately you will lose life. You'll miss out on what life is meant to be about. You could gain the whole world and run after whatever ambition you've got and ignore Jesus. Run after your ambitions and you end up losing. Because actually it's as you lose life, Jesus says, that you gain it. As you deny yourself, yeah, my desires go that way. Jesus is calling me the opposite way. I'm going to go that way, Jesus' way. It's actually as you lose life, as you deny yourself, as you take up your cross, not being ashamed of him, but being willing to be regarded as slightly weird, that actually that's the pathway to true life. Life as it's meant to be, life in all its fullness, life knowing God, life forever. Hold on to life and you end up losing it. Lose life and you end up gaining it. And Jesus says, that's the decision you've got to make, because to hold on to your life and lose it, well, that's to forfeit your soul, and you're not going to get that back. Losing life is the pathway to life. I have to be honest, it's been an interesting week, actually. I started work on this on Tuesday thinking, yeah, I've preached this passage before from other Gospels. Yeah, this is fine. By Wednesday, I thought, actually, this is quite radical. By Thursday, gosh, this is really radical. By Friday, it was good grief. This turns absolutely everything upside down. Because it does, you know. During the last 18 months, we've had to write risk assessments. Do you know what a risk assessment for Mark 8 would look like? Danger. People staying safe and holding on to their life and running after comfort. Spiritual and eternal death. I have to admit, I wish we'd put that on a risk assessment. The danger is actually a sort of cautious self-protection where I prioritize my own comfort. Jesus says that is the most risky thing you could ever do. Do you see how radical that is? We say the risky thing is giving up my comfort. Jesus says the risky thing is holding on to my comfort. Because we're following a king who goes to a cross. To be honest, I haven't got this yet because I just think, gosh, that absolutely changes everything. I'm not even scratching the surface on how much this changes. But in a day-by-day basis, I think we wake up asking the question, not what makes my life easy today, but actually, how do I follow Jesus today? I think that's the basic question each day, and that will work its way out in a plethora of circumstances. And I suspect that as we do that more, do you know what we'll find? We'll find life, actually. You know, as I talk to friends of mine who've made way, way more sacrifices than I ever have, none of them have said to me, gosh, I regret living so wholeheartedly for Jesus. I wish I'd just been a bit more half-hearted. But because actually what Jesus says is true. Actually, it is as we give stuff up for him that we find life. Because it makes sense, doesn't it? You see, if Jesus really is the Messiah, if God's plan for the universe, God's good plan for the universe, and his plan for our lives revolves around him, then life is only to be found with him at the center. And with us being wholehearted in following him. You might need to do some work in working out what are the things that take me towards my desires and my comfort and away from Jesus. Might be we need to do some work on that. To apply this to ourselves. What is it for me that leads me towards self-protection, not self-denial? That leads me away from life rather than towards life? And to say, Lord, help me to run this path. It is radical. Hugely, because, well, a Messiah who dies is radical. And we're called to follow him. I've decided to follow Jesus. No turning back, no turning back. The cross before me. The world behind me. No turning back. No turning back. Let's pray together. Just a moment of quiet. It might be we're in different positions. It may even be there's some watching this and you're in the position of sensing that this is true about Jesus, but maybe the cost of following Jesus is too much for us. We know what it might mean in certain areas of our lives. Just a moment of quiet. Maybe for you to say, Lord, help me to pay the cost. Help me to believe actually that this is the pathway to life. Or it might be for others of us, if we're Christians, we just want to marvel afresh at the strange glory of a king who goes to a cross. Or maybe for others, there's just those areas we know where self-protection and fulfilling our own selfish desires has begun to take the place of the path of the cross and living for Jesus. And maybe we just want to repent, actually, and just talk to Jesus about this. A moment of quiet, and then I'll pray. Lord, this is so hard for us at times to get our heads around. Lord, it's so easy for us to think in purely human terms. So easy to want to think in terms of ease and comfort and fulfilling our own desires. And Lord, you're before our gaze this morning as the Messiah, the King, the source of true life. And a king heading to the shame and the agony of a cross and saying, as you go there, come, follow me. And Lord, maybe even as we think about this, we sense the tussle, the wrestle within our own hearts. But Lord, help us to believe the truth that in pointing us towards the cross and inviting us to follow, you're also taking us on the pathway to life as it's meant to be. Lord, give us that ability to give up those things that look as though they bring life and ultimately bring death. And run wholeheartedly towards you and towards the cross, we pray. For your name's sake. Amen.